Hello and welcome to the Create Magic Podcast. It is Saturday, which means it's time for another installment of the Creative Weirdo segment of the podcast, where I talk to new and old friends about creativity, weirdness, and everything in between. Today, I am so excited to share with you our comic book roundtable issue 2, featuring Super Inframan and Chris Ernst. We get to talk about everything from comics, the overall mythology, and kind of state of the world in the culture and what's going on with the mythology behind it all, as well as everything from Ram Dass to magic and a whole bunch of just my favorite things to talk about, all through the lens of sequential art. And it's so nice to have people like Chris Ernst and Super Inframan in my life to get real weird and talk about some of my favorite art forms in this way. So this will definitely not be the last of these roundtables, and I'm excited for y'all to listen to it. So check all the links below to give a follow to Chris and Super Inframan and enjoy this conversation. I hope you all have the best Saturday, and I'll be back with a regular episode tomorrow. Bye. There you go.
All game.
It's on. I wanted to start recording because we were just talking about a lot of stuff that I wish I had on here already.
Yeah, say that. I mean, you can say that what you were talking about again, Super Inframan, because I think that was a pretty interesting way to, you know, start talking about comics.
I agree.
My thought on comics, which I think it's something that is overlooked a lot and it's not given credit for, but you both understand, and obviously we were talking about before we got to recording, but comics outside of radio for the longest time was probably the quickest avenue for creatives to provide like commentary on what was going on in the world. You know, you think about like TV production times, all these other things like that, that takes some time to get something out there, but you know, comics were presented in a really quick turnaround. And so you've got all of these people, and you know, think about this, like comics were rooted in Jewish immigrants in New York. And so you're getting a very interesting perspective from the very start, because a lot of times if you were Jewish and you're in New York in the 30s, like it's going to be hard for you to get a job in a lot of places being a writer or an artist. And so you're kind of stuck with this like disposable junk culture. So how do you make it meaningful? And then you have this immediate output. And that stayed with us at least through the 80s. You know, you have like civil rights movement represented with like Black Panther being all the Jim Crow ideas turned on its head. You get into the 80s when you're talking about like Alan Moore and Frank Miller doing commentaries on Reaganism and Thatcherism and things like that. So, I mean, it's always this very, very like on the nose, right under the surface, like, you know, the creator's thoughts on what's happening in the world at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even stuff like, and I, you know, I was mentioning how I felt like comics shared more in terms of the sort of media that they were presented with. And this is prior to, you know, the kind of big crossover Crisis on Infinite Earths, where I think you had that. And then like, you know, Infinity Gauntlet and sort of the 80s, there's this shift in comics. But prior to that, there was a lot more, it shared a lot more with the news. I mean, strips were originally part of newspapers, you know,
right.
And comics came around and then they were, you know, they're put on the shelf with magazines and stuff like that. And so there was, you know, you had this ability to be current and to address current issues. And I was going to mention that even in like really mainstream in the sense that like Green Lantern, Green Arrow, for a long time in the 70s, they were set up as this really like this paradigm of kind of like, you know, the stalwart good cop, you know, Americana of Hal Jordan as Green Lantern. And then Oliver Queen was like this weird hippie leftist. And that was, you know, they were trying to, you know, make this commentary and really, you know, talk about sort of the like, you know, conservative versus liberal dynamics in that. And that was just, you know, it was just part of the comics. You know, nobody made a really big deal out of it, as far as I know.
No, but you know, that's one of those things that's become landmark looking back on it. I mean,
oh yeah.
there's that great panel of the older African-American man that says something like, you know, I see you off in space and you've helped the Blueskins and, you know, whatever. He names off different colors of people and aliens and things. He goes, but when are you going to ever do anything for people that look like me, essentially? And, you know, they, gosh, I mean, they dealt with like drug addiction and everything else. I mean, it was wild. And I think they were they ended up like basically driving across the country together through all of that too? Or am I just making that part up?
I don't know. You mean the in the storyline?
Yeah, yeah.
I honestly can't remember. I'm trying to think back on those comics because it's been a while. Those are some of like the early ones that I would read when I was a real young kid. Yeah. I can't remember if they were on a road trip together. Yeah, yeah. That's great if it is. I should look back on them. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's all spot on. And, you know, something stuck out to me that you said, Super Inframan, that I think is also related to this cultural connection that comics has, and that's economics. Like comic artists have never been at the top of the heap as far as people getting paid for their art and stuff. And when you're trying to connect with culture in a certain way, usually money becomes a barrier to that connection. Like the more wealthy you get and the more famous you get, the more notoriety you get, the harder it is to truly tap into what's going on with, you know, everyday culture and everyday people. So like the fact that these comic artists were rooted in this kind of immigrant culture that may have been, you know, they may not have been the most well-off people, that probably gave them a unique ability to tap into some of these cultural narratives, whether it is things like social justice or even just like Ditko tapping into like the psychedelics and like the hippies loving him and everything through that. Yeah. And like there's so many instances of comics kind of finding its way there. But it is really interesting to me how those times that we're talking about right now, a lot of them were newsstands. Like a lot of that was before the direct distribution model, right? Because it goes from newsstands and then the direct distribution model. Is that the 80s that happened?
I think
Yeah, that was something Jim Shooter, I think, was responsible for when he was editor-in-chief at Marvel.
Yeah, that sounds right. He had a big role to play in that and a lot of stuff that I am just learning about now. He apparently, like, you know, made comics the way, like, I had no clue he was responsible for that Marvel recap in the beginning of all those Marvel books in like the 70s where you have to get a brief origin story of the superhero at the beginning of like every book, because his thing was like it could be somebody's first time reading about Daredevil. So even though you, like, you know, it's just really funny those things that get really stuck in there format wise. But it's interesting to me how it goes from newsstands in this time period that we were just talking about into a direct market, which for anybody listening who doesn't know what that is, essentially that's where comic book shops come from, and the comic books stop getting sold more ubiquitously and it becomes more of a niche culture. It becomes this collector's culture, which leads to that 90s kind of investor speculator boom, right?
And then I still have five copies of like the X-Force hologram somewhere here in my office.
Yeah. I will never not love a holographic cover. I'm sorry. I mean, there's just something too nostalgically beautiful about it. But I think it's so interesting how those kind of industry shifts and how they affect the narratives and the stories that are being told. And like, there's no one overall, because while all of this is happening, there's underground comics going on in the 60s and 70s that are like, you know, like are essentially being backed by people like, is it Leonardo DiCaprio's dad that is a huge investor in the underground comics? He's like one of the biggest comic collectors and like put a bunch of money into comics back then.
I heard that either, but I can see it.
Don't quote me on what exactly he does or did, but he has a big role that he played in comics. Leonardo DiCaprio's dad. I mainly know because of the cartoonist Kayfabe channel. They talk about it a lot when they're going through like artist collections and stuff. Apparently, he has a ridiculous collection of original.
That's art. Crazy. No kidding.
Wow. But yeah, all these other weird things are happening. And then like in the 90s, you get the alternative comics boom. And then 2000s, you get like the Small Press Expo and everything. So there's all of these things that are kind of going along at the same time. But to kind of get back to what we started talking about this with what you brought up before we started recording Super Inframan, as far as like these characters and mythologies changing with culture or reflecting culture. It's interesting to me how those industry shifts can push those culture shifts. And the culture shift that I'm going to let you explain in a minute, I don't think could happen without all of those little industry shifts that lead to like the Marvel blockbusters that we live in now, because that's like, to me, the culmination of that like speculator boom to the weird 2000s to where we are now. It's all like a direct line. And I think it has a weird pressure that it puts on the kind of way we consume these characters and these fictions and stuff. But I'm going to let you, if you can, like explain what you were talking about before we started recording as far as where you see our interaction with these superheroes right now.
So I think with superheroes particularly, but heroes in our fictional and our fantasy worlds, you know, they're the mythology that we tell ourselves. Now, whether or not that leads us or we lead it is something we should dive into more after I throw this out here. But, you know, with the tumult of the last decade or so, you know, with the kind of like feeling like things are off a little bit and what have you, you know, the superhero stories that we told ourselves started to change. You know, and you see stuff like Snyder doing Batman versus Superman, where Superman dies at the end. And then as you get a little further along and you kind of get Snyder eventually doing his Justice League, where Batman has gone from being a bitter person who thinks that all of the good people have died and doesn't give a shit anymore, to, yeah, we've done horrible things. We've killed people, but there's still good in humanity. We need Superman. And the whole movie up until the very end of the Justice League is about, we have to bring Superman back. And I kind of put that alongside things like The Last Jedi, where, you know, Luke Skywalker is found and he's a broken man that's cut himself off from the Force. And instead of being the guy that saved everybody that we saw in 1983, you know, he's this person that is just worn down by his responsibilities and life and things not going the way he anticipated, you know, and of course this is right after, I'm not sure if George Floyd had been murdered yet, but you know, we're in the thick of this.
Sure.
And we have to have, you know, these characters in these movies were trying to find themselves again and why they were heroes. And typically they found it at the last minute and then they die.
Yeah.
And then now I'm seeing this sort of vein of optimism combined with sobriety about the world, where, and I even will throw like Top Gun Maverick into this too. I think one of the reasons that movie did so well, because it had some realities in there, but it still reminded us of what we would like America to be, that idea to be. Yeah. I think
I'm curious how they represent Keaton in actuality in the new Batman.
I'm excited to Flash. See how that works.
Yeah, I'm curious if it's going to be similar to what you say, or if it's going to like how if this is like the new phase of the, or I don't know, is this the new phase of the DC universe, cinematic universe, that James Gunn, or is this the end of the previous one? Who knows?
Who knows?
I'm curious like how they're going to set it up, or if this is just the end. You know, this is a one off.
Yeah. So real quick, you know, the Black Panther sequel, of course, Chadwick Boseman died from cancer. But, you know, you have a movie that is about grief and loss and how do we pick up and keep going, which I think is really an interesting reaction to dealing with the last several years and finding, you know, our reasons to be optimistic and heroic again.
Yeah.
And so those are the things that I think are very interesting about how the stories we tell ourselves have changed. Batman in the Flash really will be interesting, because if you think about when Batman 89 came out with Keaton, mm-hmm. you know, it was, you know, we're finishing up Reaganism.
Yeah.
You know, Batman is a freaking badass in that movie, and it's humorous now if you go back and watch it, but remember how we thought it was so serious and dark. And so I'm curious to your point, like, what's this Bruce Wayne going to be like? What's this Batman going to be like?
Because there's something about the nostalgia, like, because something, you know, there is this like tension, I think, of nostalgia versus like progress that's going on in all of these. I mean, certainly in the Star Wars movies, you know, that was a big tension. And, you know, just if you think about the movies in general, like, we're in this sort of resurgence of nostalgia, Top Gun, Maverick, where it's like you have to revisit these things from some sort of glory day. But, you know, you revisit it changed or not, depending on the movie, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, to add to that, I don't know if you guys happen to watch the third season of Picard.
I haven't. It's okay. You can spoil it if you need to. I think I probably already read what it was.
Well, you know, by the end of it, the original crew of the Enterprise D is reunited. Yeah. Yeah. But they all have scars from life. They've had to, you know, kind of figure out how they relate to each other after other things have happened. But they're still glad to be with each other after all of these things that have occurred. And I really think that's interesting that you've got that happening in Star Trek after the first two seasons of Picard were much more dark.
Yeah.
And then comparing that to Star Wars, where all of the original heroes dispersed.
Yeah.
You know, Han left Leia and ran off with Chewie because he couldn't, you know, I mean, they basically left Leia to man the front and they all disappeared. Yeah. And I always find that really interesting to compare that to, like, okay, so the story we're telling ourselves about Star Trek now is that even though these things have happened, even though these people are wounded, they're hurt, they're flawed, are still coming back together as a family or whatever you want to call it, and they're kicking butt together. So I'm hoping you know, it's more than just recalling of our glory days, but is an acknowledgement of there's still optimism. There's good things that we can do, but we also are a lot more savvy to the realities of what's gone on the last decade.
Yeah.
So I will shut up now.
No, that's great.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. Chris, before I jump in, what are your immediate thoughts there from what Super Inframan just said?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that our times in many ways, again, like as we were talking about prior to starting here, it's a chicken or the egg thing. Like, you know, are we seeing reflections of, you know, the zeitgeist? Are we seeing reflections of collective consciousness? Are we seeing reflections of just, you know, what's going on in the sociocultural cycle? Or is there something that is, you know, a precursor to change? And I don't necessarily know, you know, meaning like, is this some bellwether or sign that attitudes are shifting? And I guess for me, I'm less concerned with which comes first and more with like that it's happening, like, you know. And I think it might also be like self-fulfilling or self-fueling in some way, that you get this, like, all you need is a spark. And maybe that's the question: where does that spark come from? Maybe it's just, you know, you gotta have some person in the right space, they have that, you know, inspiration, and it starts a chain reaction of things like that. Because I do think that there is something about the audience, and I, as a filmmaker, as an artist, you know, I'm not chasing it, but I do think that there are some people that chase it, and I think it's there. Like, there is sort of a sensibility, you know, and if you hit that sensibility right, if you make, you know, Clerks in the right time in the 90s, or the Blair Witch Project, or Star Wars, you know, it's just gonna hit right, and there's gonna be something that happens with it. And I guess what I'm curious is if we can have those moments anywhere, like anymore. You had talked earlier before we started recording, Todd, about this idea of like the masterpiece and how with our sort of immediate creative, or for me, I just, to be honest, I kind of don't participate in that, partially because I'm old and a professor now and I choose not to. I have the luxury of not having to do that because I don't like it. I don't want to show my process. I'm much more invested in this idea that you put forth prior to social media of somebody will, you know, create their masterpiece in their, you know, incubated artist's dark room environment or wherever. And then when it's ready, they will present it to the, you know, the world. And you can talk more about where that came from. But for me, at least, like that's, I very much am invested in that. Like that feels comfortable to me. And I'm curious if that can happen anymore. So can we have some sort of like, you know, paradigm shifting piece of media that comes out that really changes everybody's, you know, view on things? I mean, maybe something will happen and we'll look on it 20 years from now and we'll notice that it's the fact, but like, can we have something that's surprising, like a Star Wars happen anymore and really sort of shift the cultural zeitgeist? I don't know. I would love to know what that is if it's coming up.
So here's a question for both of you.
Yeah.
When you have that time to sit with your work as you're creating your masterpiece, you know, because I think all creation is a magical ritual. Does that make it the ritual stronger? I mean, in my mind it does, but I don't know if that's the case, because if you're putting everything out there, there's a certain vulnerability and all those other things too. But I don't know. I'm just curious what y'all would think of this.
Chris, you can go first if you want.
Yeah, I mean, on a very surface level, for me, having something where you see the process of it and you see little bits of it and you aren't able to take it in its entirety in the way that it was meant to be. And like, I mean, for me personally, I'm uncomfortable with the term masterpiece, especially because I make like intentionally, you know, weird cult movies, you know, that are supposed to, that like it's anti-aesthetic, so you know, totally. Masterpiece, but like for me I use the term like, you know, like a fully realized vision or creative gesture, totally, or something like that. And you know, it's, you know, very much in the mind of an auteur, you know, the author. So rather than having it be something that's made by a committee for, you know, the purposes of, you know, return on investment, you're creating something that, you know, is in many ways. And I think I know that the Alan Moore link that you sent us a link, Todd, to Alan Moore interview. And I didn't have time to listen to it today, but I think I know the one you're talking about, because I believe at some point he's talking about magic and art in that one. And he's like smoking a big spliff or something like that. I think I've seen that. Yeah. It's good. And he's talking about it in a way that I, you know, very much, you know, agree with, and that, you know, magic and art have a lot to do with each other. For me, it is very much, I think of it less of ritual and more, and if I remember correctly, I feel like Alan Moore was talking about there being like a compulsion, like you're making something because you feel this urge to like get it out. And for me, that's why I make a lot of the things that I make. And so for me, it's really important to have somebody see the thing in its entirety, in the place where, you know, you're meant to see it, you know, in a theater or something like that, because then you can really see the shape of it. Otherwise, it's like, I don't know, somebody serving you a meal and here's like one French fry and here's a pickle and here's, you know, part of a bun and here's a little bit of the hamburger. And then at the very end, maybe you'll get a quarter of the hamburger to complete the meal, but you've already had these little pieces and it's not quite complete or satisfying. So, you know, to me, it has something to do with having like being able to see something in its proper place, in its complete intended space, that I think is very important. And there's something that's maybe lost when it's, you know, you completely have the process and every bit of it sort of exposed. That can be something that's, I think, neat to see after the case, if you've digested the piece, but leading up to it, it's kind of like the wrong, it's, you know, for me, it sets the wrong tone.
Yeah, totally. I resonate with all of that and think that I tend to agree completely. And I mean, I think that my, it's less about the time spent on something for me and more about the being authentic. And like, that's where I think that a lot of the times that, and I agree that masterpiece is kind of a weird word, but that I was using that because of a podcast I listened to before where they were talking about the culture before what we live in now being a masterpiece culture where essentially creatives had more time to like work on their stuff privately before sharing it openly. Yeah. And they're also talking about how it was important for a person to have a bit of a creative to have a bit of mystique and not to have be so open publicly about everything in their lives. And like all of that stuff, it all plays a part in why that like that part of culture worked. And and I will say they weren't talking about this culture being negative and that one being positive or anything, just very just identifying differences. And I think that's a really interesting one. But yeah, as far as like how I view what I share and stuff, and I mean, I think that I'll spend an hour on something, right? And I'll share it after I made it in an hour in the morning, and that will resonate as much, if not more, with people than something I've spent like 3 weeks working on. Like I think there is something to immediacy that there can be a amplified connection with people and stuff and people, and it really comes down to what you're trying, what your goal is. And as long as your goal as the creative is not to do this thing to get the views and get the likes, if your goal is to authentically communicate something or like just put out an idea you really dig or whatever, then it doesn't matter which order or how you do it. It's all about that authenticity, and everybody has to know what works for them and how to kind of communicate their creativity authentically, especially when you're like either doing what you do, Chris, where you're making these, I mean, especially in the movie world or in the film world, I mean, there's so much that goes into it that like, you know, having that full presentation or control over how it's being consumed is a little bit more important than me spending an hour at the drawing table and posting something on, you know what I mean? Like there's a
sure
kind of commitment in there that I think is definitely it factors into something in my brain, but I don't know exactly what, but I think that there's a way to do all forms of it authentically and properly. But
yes,
I think that the magic is all about that. Like just, doing it consistently. I think the magic, and I think Alan Moore talks about that in that talk that he was saying, a lot of the comparisons he was making was linguistically, where like, you know, things just come on you and you're just inspired. Inspiration is what both mystics and artists are seeking, and like bringing back something from the unknown and being able to communicate it and stuff. I think all of those things play into it. And one of the things that I'd be really interested in knowing is like, how essentially like, and I could guess, but like, let me think here. What's the best way to say this? So like Snyder, when he's making these movies, right? You would ask him like, where'd you get the idea to like, you know, build these characters back up and bring them back together? Or Picard, like, you know, where did this third season come from? This idea of bringing and reuniting it. And I would guess that no matter who's answering that question, they'd be like, I don't know. Like it came almost every artist I've talked to in this, my brief experience with this podcast, and like, everyone I've ever really listened to where I have appreciated their creative output will cop to the fact that their best ideas, they don't know where it comes from, which puts me in the camp of I like to think about it a bunch of different ways, but my two favorites recently is that there is some sort of hand, there's something guiding these ideas and these things that are popping into artist brains, and artists are like the antennas that are poking their little antennas up into the sky and receiving these messages from whatever the divine or the universe or wherever it's coming from. And right now that thing, the universe, whatever, is being like, yo, dummies, unity, get it together, hope, these things that like are forever meaningful, like get back to it. Like that's what you need to put in these stories. So I like that idea.
Yeah.
But I also like the idea that it speaks to how time is just not as linear as we think it is. And there's something special to the artist, whether it's a comic artist or a director or a writer, that can tap into these non-linear sections so they can see that. They don't know they're seeing it, but they're seeing that 20 years down the line, we need more hope. So we need to insert it in the mythology now, and we need to change these superheroes now. You know what I mean? So I don't know which one of those I like better these days, but I like to go through. Those are my two favorites.
I mean, it could be both. Like, why not both? Exactly. You know, it's and I think about both of those things, too. Yeah, that if. I remember more that talk because I think I watched it pretty recently. Somebody else had sent me a link to it. And he's talking about, how God, I'm trying to remember. Well, one part that if I remember correctly at the end, he's talking about magic and art, and he's saying how he feels like magic and art should learn. They should cross paths, and that, like, you know, artists should try to accomplish what magicians are doing, and magicians should try to approach things the way artists are doing. And that, I remember when I heard that, that made a lot of sense to me, because he's saying something about how, like, artists, you know, should be trying to, you know, essentially create these rich, create things that are going to impact reality, you know, and that magicians should be thinking about, you know, creating things that are, you know, like in or like letting that sort of intuitive thing talk to them. I don't know. Maybe he said something different than that. But the general thing was like artists and magicians should try to like cross paths and, you know, try the approach that each other's are doing. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I think that's a great way to look at it, because I mean, if it's both of those things, you know, at one point I remember thinking of like trying to describe, you know, the way that I approach art as like remote viewing in like a 360 degree way, just sort of like throwing it out there. And this is even prior to when David Lynch did the whole Catching the Big Fish. And if people aren't familiar with that, David Lynch, big transcendental meditation guy, he gets a lot of his inspiration during his meditation, where he goes into, you know, essentially, but I think, you know, he believes the para-atma, the oversoul, collective unconscious, and that he talks about how you're going for the big fish. So you're essentially diving deep into that collective unconscious, and you're trying to bring things back out. You know, like, those are both cool ways. I mean, you know, his is cooler than mine, but those are both ways I think that, you know, for me resonate, you know, in terms of creating art. They both seem appropriate, and I don't think everybody feels that way, but for me, that, like, I guess that goes down to that authenticity, which, again, it's not like you don't have to go away for 3 years and come back with something. You can do an immediate piece of authentic art. It just depends on, you know, what it is. Yeah, but that approach, those approaches, that way of thinking about it, rather than it being something that is fruitlessly aesthetic, or, you know, it can still be aesthetic, but it's, I guess, what fuels me.
Yeah. So, you know, as an ambassador of the source and Jack Kirby,
I love it.
You know, I need to find these interviews out there, but there is audio recording of Jack talking about the source, and as if it's a very real thing where all creative ideas come from. And so, you know, he transposed that into his work, but he obviously found his way to that before he put that into the New Gods and the Fourth World. And I really thought that was fascinating, that, you know, this was his personal cosmology that he worked in around, like, basically saying, like, I'm connected to something that is the creative essence of the universe, and it's where all good ideas come from. And it's so parallel to, like, what you're talking about with Lynch and things like that. And I'm like, I don't know. It's kind of gives me like chills or goosebumps or something to think that these, like, you know, really intense creatives found themselves at this same sort of, idea about where their ideas are coming from.
I mean, I think it's true. I really do.
One thing I was going to throw out there, since we were talking about ideas coming from places and what have you, is you know, somebody like Morrison doing All-Star Superman. Like, I think Morrison is secretly a futurist. Because he's always so far ahead about how he talks about what he thinks people are going to be like. Like, you know, when he wrote Zenith, which is like the first thing he really, really did, you know, it was his idea of what he thought people would do fashionably and things like that in a lot of ways. Like, he thought people were going to dress like superheroes.
Yeah.
But, you know, you end up with like something like All-Star Superman, which came along in a time when I don't know if it was called for, but it was appreciated. And it continues to have this outsized influence, and maybe outsized is the wrong term there, because it's an incredible, incredible piece of work.
Yeah.
And it's not even something that I would say is that typical of him all the time either. You know, his stuff tends to be a little bit more in the mud a little bit, and a little more grimy, and a little bit more like, self-immolation or something like that. And yeah, that's not in All-Star Superman. But, you know, when you see Gunn talking about his Superman project, you know, it, the imagery from All-Star Superman is like all over that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope it would be. I mean, that is the, like, yeah, quietly nailed it. I mean, like, that is
quietly. Oh God, Superman. Yeah.
Like, those pictures of him sitting on the clouds and like looking like they're forever burned into my brain. And I may be misremembering this, but I'm pretty sure I've heard Morrison talk about like distinctively making a turn in those like early 2000s to making more positive comics, to going back to that idea.
I feel like I've heard that too. Yeah.
That, like, you know, superheroes need to be a bastion of hope and a symbol of what they need to be. And like, he really wanted, and I think All-Star Superman was like his first, like, full or his biggest project in within that. And I think there's something really special because he's somebody that has thought so much about the way that culture consumes these characters, and the, and so what I was actually, that this works out perfect to what I was going to say a second ago is, so I've been thinking a lot about the idea of how different creatives relate to that idea space that Alan Moore calls it, right? That the idea space or the oversoul, like that they all, there's so many names for it. And
yeah.
And then I've been thinking about this. I've been rereading Sandman recently, right? And I just got past like where Death gets introduced and it gets really good, right? Yeah. But there's been a few things that have really stuck out to me rereading it this time, and one of them is the issue where he goes to hell to get his helmet back, right? And he goes, there's a whole bunch, and this is one thing that Gaiman does amazingly, where he interweaves like actual mythology and folklore and literature into like the DC world, and it's hard to tell what's what, so I still probably get things wrong all the time. But he talks about Hell's Graveyard, which I'm pretty sure is actually from Dante's Inferno. And what Hell's Graveyard is if you die essentially like an atheist, or believing that you just die and you're in the ground, then you go to Hell's Graveyard. You go into the ground forever and you're in the graveyard. And so essentially like your afterlife is co-created. Like whatever you believe at the time is what you're going to experience in the afterlife. And I've heard other people talk about those ideas. And I kind of think the same thing can be applied to how these creatives like a Jack Kirby get so connected to these things. Once you start seeing yourself as connected to that creative oversoul or that cosmic source, then like that's just going to reinforce that connection and make it so that you actually are. So it's one of those things where it's like as much perception and how you perceive yourself as it is, you know. So I don't know if anybody can, like, you know, have do what a Jack Kirby did or tap into the same thing that he did, but I think everybody can access that if we like look at ourselves right in a certain way.
I totally agree. And I think it's, you know, to pull from some really like, you know, sketchy stuff, the like whole positive thinking, you know, Neville Goddard, up through the Secret Oprah stuff, like, you know, think and it will manifest. the thing is that there's efficacy to that, and that's why it's been turned into, you know, different weird pyramid schemes and, you know, mm-hmm. people, you know, using it for, you know, strange means. There was something I was what was it? I think it was called like cubism, starting with a Q, and it's like quantum I'm going to mispronounce it. It's quantum Bayesianism or something like that. It was something I was reading about recently where somebody was talking about, and it's essentially, it's the same thing. It's, you know, you're saying, I believe this, or I am a person who attracts, you know, wealth, or I am a person who is lucky. And, you know, I know a lot of people who, you know, to some greater or lesser degree, there's a return on that. Like, mm-hmm. but it's in the same way that people who are chaos magicians get a return on things. It's like, right. you can't all of a sudden have a 5,000 foot, you know, inflatable living dog appear on your lawn just because you will it to be so and you believe it, because there's no like there's no juice, there's nothing around here to make that happen. But you do have, you can impact and affect things that are within the realm of your sort of reach and reality. And I don't mean that you can't affect something far off, but it's like, it's like smaller things, you know. It's like, if you have to push reality in a particular way, it can't be this huge push, because that'll throw reality off for everybody else. It has to be small enough so that it can be something that isn't going to, like, I don't know, shift the entire, you know, quantum future of the world or something like that. That's the way that I think about it when I hear about this thing.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And we have to have some perception for it. Like, we can't, if it's completely out of the, if it's something that's never been pictured or actually existed in nature, then it would make sense that we can't just manifest that. And, like, you know, we, that lines up pretty good. And I think there's so many instances where I'll listen. I've been listening to a lot of different, like, creatives, like more modern creatives talk, 'cause I'm interested in what they, like, what other people are consuming. And it's all so much of the same stuff. Like, well, like, it's so funny. But it essentially, like, they're all sigil workers. They just don't know it. They're all doing it. They just don't know they're doing it. And it's really interesting when you listen to it with that kind of idea. And so here's something else that I wanted to run by you all that hit me with Sandman, and I'm very interested in this idea. But so I heard Gaiman talk in an interview where essentially one of the things he was trying to do with, like, those first, is the first 6 or 7 issue arc, where essentially the first trade, where he's escaping from being imprisoned and then collecting all of his items and, like, going, you know, doing that whole journey, right? And essentially what Gaiman, one of the things he was trying to communicate, that one of the reasons that we seem to have always been a magical people and always been a magic beings and, like, invested in magic in our culture, and then it stops in the 20th century, is because that's when Dream gets locked up. And without dreams, there's no magic in the world. Yeah. And then when he gets out, and that's where it all gets re-released into the 21st century and where we're at now. And anytime there's, like, something that's held and something that's, like, constricted, that when it releases, it's going to expand way further. And, like, I've been thinking about that a lot with this big boom in this magical kind of, just the fact, like we were talking about earlier, that there's more, it's more accepted to talk about being a spiritual person, and, like, there's more of, like, this acceptance that there's something more going on than whatever rational materialism has to say about it. And, like, that, again, to go back to Alan Moore, one of the things he said about the artists and magicians connection is essentially, like, he's like, I don't want to throw away materialism or science or rationalism or anything.
Right.
They deal with everything outside the body. They deal with this whole physical material world. Exactly. I'm saying the artists and the magicians deal with the inner world, and that might be more expansive and way bigger than the outer world could ever be. So we need to elevate those things. And I think there's something to that, that
I 100% agree. I mean, that's very much aligned with, you know, sort of my personal, you know, stance on things. I think that's really smart when he says that, because I do think that, you know, that loss of sort of the inner world, that You know, and again, it's tough. I mean, you know, I don't want to say, you know, there's nothing necessarily wrong with the rise of the scientific method and the materialism that goes along with it because of the, you know, the many things that it provides. But I do think that there is, and I talk about this a lot when people, you know, interview me, this book by Gary Lachman, used to be Gary Valentine, the bass player for Blondie. Oh, yeah. And he writes these really great books. You know, he's fairly learned about the occult and Western esotericism. And if you haven't read any of his books, people should pick him up. Does some really good stuff. And he has this one book called Lost Knowledge of the Imagination, where he's essentially talking about, you know, this, you know, loss that happened during, you know, the Enlightenment, where, you know, I think he's particularly talking about like Coleridge and a couple of other artists and stuff like that, poets and artists. And he's talking about imagination and the sort of the inner world as this other part of reality that is equally as valid as the physical reality we inhabit, that was lost as a real space to, you know, work in and to express, and that the reality of living in that space that was happening with these artists sort of at the shift during the Enlightenment is, you know, something he's sort of arguing for it being lost. And I very much think that that's, you know, the case from my perspective. And when, you know, so the way that Moore states it, I think is a really good way of, you know, sort of parsing what could be a good model. If you take, you know, artists and people that are thinking in, you know, non-empirical ways as like the other side of the coin. And what can we discover if we have both of these sides working simultaneously?
And like, don't discount one or the other. Like, so one of the things that's really interesting when you brought up New Thought and things like Neville Goddard and stuff, it's interesting to me how much science is bearing out all of that stuff is real now. Right. Like the mind-body connection and things like the simple counting stuff, like just stopping and counting 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, like completely changes our neurobiology, they found. And like all these simple things that sound really cheesy growing up that you hear, and like, you know, these anger management stuff, it's all real, and it all like high-fiving yourself in the mirror and stuff like that. It all goes a long way. And it like they're now able to map the weird things that happen in our brains and like can say, oh wait, that shit they were talking about in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, they was right. And we probably should have. We would have done ourselves a good service to listen to those things a lot sooner.
Chris, you probably know more about this than I do, but I think a lot of that rejection of spirituality during the Enlightenment was trying to get away from the church controlling things and their power. Because, you know, the scientific method and all these things came from alchemists, too. I mean, these guys were magicians. Like, they were.
You're completely right. There it used to be that science and magic were, I mean, John Dee is sort of the father of modern science. And he's, you know, he's more of a magician than he is, you know, many current magicians. Absolutely. And I think it was religion and not spirituality they were trying to fight against. And it was trying to fight against, you know, their current sort of, you know, theocratic, you know, rule, which very much was in the way of the sort of positivism. That's what I was trying to say, of science. Yeah.
Well, I think, Go ahead, Tom. No,
I was just going to say real quick, you know, the other thing that as this is coming back around, what I, you know, y'all both heard me talk about this at different times, but the psychedelics being embraced by the medical community. Mm-hmm. And I keep seeing that like growing more and more and more. My friend that, you know, I've kind of followed along his journey and let him go first and everything, is in another part of the world right now, doing LSD with our doctor, and he's loving it. And every time he tells me about it, I just get like, I get friggin' jealous. Cause I'm like, I would love to try that in that kind of environment where it's like, you know, so intentional and set up and understood and supported and everything like that. But, you know, even on Instagram today, I'm seeing, you know, like New York Times articles, different scientists I follow, and it's, you know, shrooms, LSD, DMT, you know, how these things can improve your life.
And I think that lines up so much with what we were just talking about, because for a scientist that is a materialist, here is a material way into the spiritual world. Like, here is a key. Here is a thing you can hold instead of just like sitting and meditating or in delving into imaginal exercises and these things. And like, that key is really important. Like, I think that key, it's not, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just say it just makes sense that that's their access point as far as like scientism goes, because now they have something they can hold. And so there was, have I talked to either of you about the extended DMT experiments they're doing, where essentially they're taking the technology from anesthesia?
Yeah, they're doing this IV, so you can have a continuous steady. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a 6-hour trip, and they're having like anesthesiologists administer it. And they're like, it's in Britain, somewhere in the UK, they're doing it. And they're having like, it's been a year that they've been doing it now. And like, they're having the first, and like, crazy, amazing stuff's coming out about how positive and like how, like, you know, very interesting that essentially like this space that we got access to via these chemicals for just like brief glimpses, right? These things that like people brought back and they say they live a lifetime in 10 minutes or these things through DMT. Now you can be in there for, you know, how many 10 minutes are in 6 hours. Like, that's how many lifetimes can you go through. And like, if the idea of like reincarnation and these things, as far as like soul leveling up and these like playing out, essentially using the earth as this way to like I don't want to say cleanse souls, but essentially like have your soul go through this process via living in earth and these living these different lives to get to be a better person and kinder and more open. If you can do that via a 6-hour DMT trip instead of like 30 lifetimes, like, is that a thing? I don't know. That's where my brain goes sometimes. Like, if you can live like that many lifetimes in one, and I'm very familiar with, you know, the spiritual bypassing that psychedelics can allow in certain ways and whatnot, but I'm like, that seems like it's initiate, like that's another level of shamanic experience. I mean, at that point,
the way that I see and this is just, you know, my experience from the sort of the people that I've talked to and the studying that I've done, is that, like, you know, all of these ethnogens, they're the same thing. You know, I mean, they are achieving similar results to what you're going to get with a very intense yogic practice. But what all that it's doing is sort of shifting your consciousness so you can see like shadows of sort of, you know, the other side, the subtle world, the spiritual world, and that, you know, it can work as a like a catalyst, but that it's not, it's at least, and this is merely from the mystics that I have, you know, studied, that it's not like, it's not a shortcut. Essentially, there is no shortcut. It's like, you know, but maybe that's wrong. I mean, maybe you are right and you can sort of, you know, get rid of a bunch of karma or do something that way. Yeah.
I wouldn't claim that at all. I know that I mean, the one I'm most familiar with is the Ram Dass story, where he gives Neem Karoli Baba a shit ton of like the strongest LSD that's ever been made. And Neem Karoli Baba just laughs at him, is like, I'm here all the time. Like, so nothing.
I mean, that's interesting. Yeah. Because Ram Dass actually, at the same visit, he visited the guy that who's the guru that my parents followed. And so I was studying and I went to India several times. This guy, Meher Baba, and he was he actually came out against, he was telling people not to do drugs as like a spiritual way to sort of, and he was very explicit that a lot of people don't know, is that he was saying that if you're using these things with a doctor or using these things in a sort of formalized way, and, you know, this is a guy who didn't actually speak, so the way in which you have to translate what he's saying, like, from my interpretation, he was essentially saying, you know, working with a shaman or a doctor or somebody where you're not like a hippie in Berkeley who's downing a bunch of LSD saying, I see God, you know, that can be super dangerous, you know? And that was one of the things that he told Ram Dass. He was like, you know, he was essentially saying that, he's like, you know, you do it a few more times, but this should just be a catalyst for something like you should realize from the experiences that you have, that should be sort of like the spark that lets you do it on your own. You know, if that makes any sense. And I think, you know, I mean, I don't know, but I find it interesting, you know, all those guys like Ram Dass went, you know, with Richard Alpert and these other guys, Dreyfuss and all these other guys, they're all part of the same like Harvard school. And some of these guys stayed with Meher Baba. Some of the guys went with Ram Dass and ended up becoming devotees of Neem Karoli Baba. But Neem Karoli Baba and Meher Baba, I think both were absolutely, they're part of what I consider the real ascended masters. They're these guys from everything that I've seen, these are like the real saints. You know, these are the guys that actually have the real knowledge of stuff. I love that story of Neem Karoli Baba because he takes like an enormous amount and he's like, oh yeah, he says something like, oh yeah, this used to be yogi medicine. This is what yogis in the valley over there used to do, but they haven't done it in a long time or something like that, which is similar to what Meher Baba said. He was like, yeah, this used to be a big part of practice, you know, here a long time ago, but people don't do it the right way anymore.
Oh, interesting.
One part of the Neem Karoli Baba story, and I'm pretty sure it was the same, maybe a later interaction, but at one point he's told Ram Dass that way of entering is through the back door. And why would you want to come through the back door when you can come through the front door through, you know,
that's very similar stuff that I've been.
And that's really because sometimes you got to kick down the back door. Like sometimes that is what absolutely. You got to do. But like you said, it should lead to people like Ram Dass and those guys, it led to a whole bunch of different things that are, I mean,
completely.
One of my favorite, and this is so funny, we got to this part way more than comics at this point, but one of the things that I love about those teachers and those people is the humor in all of their teachings.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I was listening to this dude earlier talk about essentially the way that esoteric and religious or spiritual scripts and documents are translated, the main thing that gets left out is the humor. And that, like, if we could read all of these things in the native languages, there would be these jokes and these puns. And he used the story of the Garden of Eden as an example. Apparently, in the original language, it was written in to be undressed and to be clothed. It's a pun. There's a pun that's there. And so the whole thing is like set in this pun. And it's and if you think about it, it's kind of a silly story. And like, it makes sense that there would be like a little bit of humor in there. And I'm like, that makes so much sense to me, because when you listen to the stuff that's oral and that's why I resonate with someone like Ram Dass so much, is when you listen to him, it's funny. He's hitting for jokes. He's going for lines. And like, same thing. I don't know. I really love that humor and absurdity seems to be such a base part of that, of those teachings.
And that's actually a big part of what a lot of the Indian gurus I do think you have to sort of parse out, because I think some of them are bunk and some of them aren't. Yeah. I know that's, you know, it's hard to say who is who, but at least from my, you know, the research, some of them both probably, but the ones I think that, you know, didn't do anything. And I take it, you know, there's some like the Maharishi, the guy who founded Transcendental Meditation. You know, you get these stories of monetary, physical abuse, things like that. And those are the sort of things you want to watch out for. So when I come across some folks that don't have any of that, that's when I'm like, oh, all right, I'm going to look at this person who doesn't have 30 Rolls Royces and got a couple of people pregnant. Like, what's the deal with them? And not to say that you know, maybe there isn't something to these other guys. Obviously, like David Lynch has, you know, pulled a bunch of stuff out of the collective unconscious through the teachings of the Maharishi. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I think like somebody like Neem Karoli Baba or Meher Baba or a lot of these guys, they all were really silly. Like they were jokers. Complete tricksters, to the bone tricksters. Like, and I absolutely agree that you get a lot of that lost. And I wonder if you were going to go back and like see the teachings of somebody like, you know, sorry if I offend anybody by saying, you know, Jesus Christ or Muhammad. Are these people going to be, you know, I'm not talking about the Bible or the Quran. I'm talking about like if you actually, you know, had the real interaction, if these were real human beings, like, were they the same? You know, were they like also tricksters and jokers? And I think that there is some evidence to that. It's really faint because it's very far back. But yeah, I'm with you on that, Todd. I think it's a really cool thing that more people are sort of like understanding like the non-gravitas of spirituality, how it's not this like grave, solemn thing. It's like a funny, weird, tricksterish, strange, joking thing.
Totally.
You know, so I brought up that with Jeremy Vaney the other day as a parallel, because we were talking about the occult and paranormal and things like that, where, you know, his sense of humor, I almost think it makes it like easier for him to interact with all of these things. And if you don't have that, like, what happens? Because it is an absurd experience, a lot of these things. But, you know, I think it, particularly with like the paranormal side of things or the occult side of things, there's this desire to be taken seriously. So that humor gets bleached out. But, you know, one of the reasons like I love Vuk is because he cracks jokes about everything. And it gets back to that, like, you've got to have that core element of trickster or prankster or jokester. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're all talking about the same stuff. It's just how are we getting to it? And I think that's just so fundamental.
I got to look up this dude's.
I was just going to say that's something that I feel like Alan Moore was talking about that in that interview that Todd had mentioned prior to us talking, is that, he's talking about, I think, Robert Anton Wilson, I believe, is talking in it.
He's being interviewed for their estate after he passed
That's
away
what it is. And that's why I've seen that before, because, yeah, it's most things, if it had, but that makes sense why I would have seen it. Yeah, but Robert Anton Wilson, I mean, you know, consummate jokester, you know, humor was such a big part of the stuff that he was doing. I believe in that interview, what I was going to say is that, like, Alan Moore was talking about how he had this experience or this vision where he was in, like, a white room with all of these famous these magicians that were really important to him, like True Crowley Illuminati. And Austin Osmond Spare and John Dee and stuff like that. And Robert Anton Wilson was there, but he hadn't passed yet. And he also saw in the background, I guess, there were like animal headed figures, some kind of like in the distance. And he was talking about that in the context of like magical sort of, you know, adepts and practitioners, but also how, since Wilson hadn't died yet, one of the things that it made him think about was something you had mentioned earlier, Todd, which is this idea of like the block universe, like time not being something that is, or time being something that is, you know, immediate or all at once. Past, present, and future. And so in that case, you know, Moore is experiencing not just, you know, the adepts that are guiding him from the past, but also the ones that are still there that have yet to pass, you know.
Totally. And that experience was like a month or 2 weeks. It was really close to Robert Anton Wilson's passing.
Right.
So that was also really pressing. He had, at the end of that video, he reads this, I don't know if he wrote it as part of a celebration of Rawls' life or what it was essentially, but it was just this beautiful, I mean, it sounds like Moore doing his best Rawl, and it ends with that experience and him retelling it. And it's so good and gives me goosebumps all the time. But both of those dudes, I mean, beautiful examples of modern day tricksters. Robert Anton Wilson might be the dude that broke this world more than anybody.
And
both good and like the word disinformation, I don't think people understand how much that was tied to somebody like Robert Anton Wilson before.
Or even the word Illuminati exist in the same form were it not for him using that.
And like the Illuminatus, that trilogy, maybe they'll know more than ever now, because I know like even on the newest the Newkirks have that new podcast, they do Haunted Objects, and they talk about how the Illuminati is pretty much defined by the Illuminati that Robert Anton Wilson. And what was the co-author? Do you know the co-author's name off the
Rob, and
I always feel so bad.
It was Malachi the Younger, or Yeah, you're right. I should know this.
But yeah, essentially, they all the tropes we think of with the Illuminati came from those books, and the amount of and meme he was had such a huge influence as far as the popularity of memes in the culture and that whole idea. But one of the things I wanted to say before we got talking about Raw that has to do with tricksters is
Robert Shea,
thank you. Yeah. Thank you for looking that up. That's something the host probably should have done, but you know.
It's all right. I should know that. I really should know that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, yeah. There was this podcast I was listening to. I mentioned this guy earlier. He is Dr. Justin Sledge is his name. Have you guys heard of this dude?
He's familiar.
He has a PhD in paranormal something that he got in Amsterdam, which apparently you can get PhDs in paranormal stuff, right? But he said this thing that was really interesting to me. They were talking about the trickster motif in paranormal and with gods in general, whether it's like Hermes or, what's the monkey god that...
Hanuman.
Okay. Yeah, like these gods that embody trickster mentality. He's like, really? All gods are tricksters, because to play a trick on somebody, the main thing you need is to know a little bit more than that person that you're tricking.
Yeah.
And if my god doesn't know a little bit more than me, I don't really want him. So like the whole trickster motif in his view is a way to show that like leveling up of the being that like that being is. And that's something I'd never really applied to that trickster motif in a very, or I'd never heard people talk about too much or thought about in my own way. And I was like, that's a really good point, because I agree.
Well, I mean, it makes perfect sense with like a stage magician, because he knows how the trick is done, but you don't.
Yep.
And the reason it's a trick is because you don't know how it was done.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
The deception is why it works.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Illusions are, it's so funny. Magic is something that comes up all the, like stage magic has been coming up for me a lot in recent conversations. Like my kid's really into it right now. He's not really into, and I don't know where it came from, but he got really into like magic YouTube, like the sleight of hand tricks and stuff like that. Yeah. Right. And and I'm like, that's a whole world that I know nothing about, but it seems endlessly fascinating to me. At some point I know AP Strange is super into it. So maybe I'll have him on to pick his brain about magic and stage magicians at some point.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, this went all over way from comics, and we're about an hour in here, y'all. So I didn't have anything in particular to ask you all about, like, you know, any kind of particular comic theme or anything like that for this one, like we did the last one. But is there anything that you've been into recently? Like I mentioned, I've been rereading the Sandman stuff. That's been really sparking a lot of different ideas. Like rereading, I haven't read it. It's probably been like 10 years, maybe more than that since I've read it. Or definitely haven't read it since I'm as knowledgeable, or I was not as knowledgeable about mythology and folklore as I am now. So I'm able to pick apart some of those things that like he puts in there and weaves in a little bit more. But I also, there's so much stuff in there that like, there's these little lines that stick out to me more than ever that are just beautiful. Like there's like when he's leaving hell and they're like, well, why should we let you leave? Like you got your mask, but why should we let you leave? You're here. And essentially he's like, well, if people can't dream of heaven, is there a hell? And I'm like, damn, that means that's like those little lines that he like puts at those. So good. Like Gaiman is, I mean, he's real fresh. Like you can tell he's just throwing up a bunch of like softballs in those first seven issues and see what hits. And like, you don't know what's going to stick around. You can tell he's really trying some stuff out. But when he nails things like that, he really. And the other thing that I forgot that's so beautiful is each culture perceives dream through their culture. So he like he looks to us, but when he goes to Africa, he looks like an African deity. And like, talk about that co-creation, like underlying like thing being in there. That is, I really believe that like, you know, I know Gaiman's a very well-read person and like they have plenty of esoteric knowledge and all of that good stuff, but those little truth nuggets that seep in there, I think
it's
special.
Pretty amazing.
Totally. But yeah, is there anything y'all have been reading or really into recently on the comics front?
You know, so I went back and I've started rereading Starman.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, nice.
Yeah, because you know it's like if AP Strange was a superhero.
Yeah,
I mean, Starman's it kind great. Of is.
I'd never thought about it like that, but that's perfect.
it's fantastic, and you know there's a lot of great liminal qualities with it, and it's, you know, there's a little bit of discussion within the book where he's kind of actualizing his approach to being Starman, where he's got a zodiac pattern on the back of his jacket, and he's more occult minded. But Starman had traditionally been a scientific atomic age hero, and that's who his family was. But my favorite thing in there probably is there's a circus that recurs where he runs into a circus that comes into town and meets the people in it. And I love this idea of a sort of magical circus that comes around and causes you to have realizations, and then it's gone again. And then you have to figure out, was it even there? And just all that stuff. So I'm really enjoying that. The other thing that is so much more mainstream, World's Finest.
Yeah.
You know, Superman and Batman, Mark Waid's writing it. I think Dan Mora's the artist on it, maybe.
Yeah. It's good.
Yeah, it's good. Really good. That's awesome. Like what I... My memories of what the Super Friends cartoon was like.
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It is solid, like, superhero stuff, but there's some intelligence to it that's just a little deeper, and you get to actually see, like, oh, I get why Superman and Batman are, like, you know, consider themselves brothers in a way, as opposed to... you know, we're these diametrically opposed ideas, and anyway.
I had gone back actually and reread recently Morrison's Seven Soldiers of Victory, which I could only do like digitally very easily because of the weirdness of it being all over. And if people don't remember that, it actually is one of my favorite Morrison things because it's a really weird. It's essentially where it's in the 2000s. He took this old, you know, another one, old property, the Seven Soldiers of Victory, but now it's rethought and it goes across all of these. It's got like Frankenstein, Bulleteer, Clarion, Clarion, the Witch Boy, Shining Knight, Manhattan Guardian, Zatanna. Anyway, it's redone where they're essentially, they don't realize it, but they are all part of this larger universal force that is making them work in concert with one another to defeat the Shida, which is essentially Grant Morrison's evil fae, you know, coming from an alternate dimension. But I really, you know, it's this great sort of metafiction, and it's, you know, re-looking at how comics are read and sort of linearity. But I also like this idea that, you know, it's, they're all working towards this, creating this sort of common occurrence happening, but they don't realize they're doing it, which is something that I, you know, think about a lot in terms of how this world works. So I think it's, you know, really great. If you want to revisit something from the 2000s, that's like, for me, a less popular Morrison DC thing, because it's not like the multiversity, you know, it's but it's really worth it.
Hey Chris, did that play into the Mr. Miracle Shiloh Norman stuff, or was that separate?
I don't think so. I think that was separate. No, he was in that. Yeah, of course Mr. Miracle was part of that. Yeah, it did. Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm confusing. I'm now thinking of Tom King Mr. Miracle, which is a completely different thing. I'm confusing stuff in my head.
That ties back into, he picks up a lot of the strands from that in Dark Crisis.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just think it makes it even cooler. But nobody read that when it came out. And I had missed it completely. And one of the guys at the comic book shop had recommended it to me. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, because it comes up in Final Crisis. Is that what you said again?
Final Crisis.
Comes
up in Final Crisis, and, you know, it ties into like Darkseid and all of those things again. And
Speaking of DC and Tom King and all of that stuff, I have also been reading Danger Street, which is the new like Tom King, whatever you want to call it. I think it's part of DC Black Label, but it's him essentially doing like, I haven't finished it yet, but it's like all of these weird obscure figures, and it's all set with the conceit of like somebody walks in with Dr. Fate's helmet and puts it on a bar, and each comic starts with like the this shot in a very sort of, you know, Watchmen 12 panel way of like, you know, next on our story, and it's this Dr. Fate helmet talking to you while the person who ostensibly has it is like drinking a beer in the background. It's, you know,
it's awesome.
Yeah, I like Tom King stuff. You know, he might be a CIA plant, but he's great.
That's
fine. Those are great recommendations and all sound wonderful. I haven't read most of them, so I'm going to definitely check those out. Do you guys, as far as like Super Inframan, what you were saying with the overall kind of move, the narrative of the big Marvel and the DC movies and like that, that kind of unification and that rebuilding up of the superhero, is that consistent with like the books that are coming out that you're reading on as far as like the World's Finest and stuff? Like, is that in there?
I would say it's definitely in World's Finest, because it is an idealized version of the characters, but it is back to that, like, you know, they're not naive. You know, they understand the impact that they have and how they have to navigate things and the politics of the world and things like that. And so, yeah, I think it's definitely reflected there. I'm excited to see what Gunn does as he starts making movies that are truly under his kind of oversight, because he's such a creative and he has such a distinct voice. You know, and Chris, you've talked about this, like, how often do you have somebody that gets to have that much influence over tentpole movies? I mean, it just doesn't happen. And I'm curious to see what he does.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I am too. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like with him, there is a calling back to what superheroes are.
Yeah,
I think his version of Batman will be more of like a superhero Batman, because we've got Matt Reeves' patents and stuff. That's more of the, low fantasy detective, hard boiled noir story. Yep. So I suspect we'll see somebody that's got a little bit more of a smiles because he enjoys dispensing justice.
I mean, in theory, they're doing The Authority, which I'm really curious to see how they do.
Really? Know. That's interesting. Yeah. Whoa. Okay. That's
These are all cool. like rumors of what's on their slate. But yeah.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Super interesting. Well, that'd be an interesting couple years of movies here. Awesome. Well, dudes, thank you so much for hanging out and talking comics and magic and weirdness and all kinds of stuff. This was a blast.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. It's so nice to just nerd out and be able to kind of roam and not have any specific thing to cover. And yeah, this was great. Do you all have anything you'd like to plug at the moment? And you like to tell people anything you want to find? Chris, you want to go first?
Oh, well, I mean, you can always still go look at the, you know, movies that me and my collaborators made. You can go to Amazon Prime to find them, or Troma Now, or just go to brightrectangle.com and you'll find links to those. Yeah.
Awesome. Super Inframan, anything you'd like to share?
You know, I'm just hanging out, having a good time. I will say I got to stop by and see Soraya in New York a couple weeks ago, and we made a lot of video. And so at some point, I'm sure he'll put all that up. So that should be fun.
You guys visited a cool graveyard, I hear.
We did.
He said it was pretty, at least Soraya said he said it had a vibe or something like that.
I mean, and there were, you'll see in the video, but like people had obviously been out there like practicing, you know, some type of magical rituals. Some of them look like stuff that I made when I was 13. And some of them look like very like, okay, this person drove a long way to get this piece of a branch to put on this. Oh, and, weird. You know, so it'll be fun.
That's cool. That's awesome, man. That sounds like a super fun trip. Were you out there for something else, or did you just go out to visit Soraya?
You know, I've got family that's not too far from him. So, made the trek over and, we had fun. Yeah.
That's awesome. Very cool. Well, thank you again, guys, for being here. It's super appreciated. I hope you enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll definitely do it again. I think that there's maybe not even having the comics theme next time and just talking about it. I'd love to get into all the other stuff and not have any, you know, yeah, who knows? We can
talk about it all, man. No problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, you all have a great night. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you, guys. Bye. We'll be right back.